From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, one of the nation's leading satirists, P.J. O'Rourke, joins us in studio for a discussion all about politics and his new book, Don't Vote, It Just Encourages the Bastards. It's his 14th book, and he'll join us for the hour, which will include your calls, emails, and online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. P.J. O'Rourke is the author of two New York Times bestsellers, Parliament of Whores and Give War a Chance, the former writer for Rolling Stone and editor-in-chief of the National Lampoon. He recently published his 14th book. It's titled Don't Vote, It Just Encourages the Bastards. And we welcome P.J. O'Rourke back to Forum, wearing a red tie and looking very spiffy. And I must say, power tie, in fact.
Is that what that is?
That's what that's supposed to be.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was like last clean tie in a suitcase was what it actually is.
How much of a suitcase do you take? You're on a big book tour.
I'm gone from home for a month, and fortunately, I'm one of these very conventional middle-aged male dressers, and so it's like two dark suits and a bunch of shirts, and I'm good to go. You know,
nobody would take you for a kid from Toledo, Ohio. That's for sure.
Oh, well, I don't know. There's a lot of kids from Toledo, Ohio, look pretty much like me.
Really?
Yeah,
but you have
back there
that aura of success with you that suggests Washington or New York.
Well, nice of you to say. I don't know whether it's – I think it may be a false aura, but nonetheless, yes, Toledo is missing a little bit of the aura of success these days, alas. I go back there fairly often, and as I go back to the Rust Belt in general, and I give them tremendous points for school spirit. They're all – trying to reinvent themselves from Flint to Grand Rapids to Toledo and Akron, Dayton, and they're having a heck of a time of it. It's not pretty. No.
You know, I was thinking this mantle that you have, funniest writer in America and all that. Last time you were on, we talked very seriously about Adam Smith, and you are a guy who has a lot of serious thoughts, especially about politics, that come across in this book, despite the satire and the humor in it. And I was thinking, that's kind of a mantle of responsibility, you know, to have. I mean, people do expect you to be funny often, don't they?
And yeah, well, Dave Barry's the funniest writer in America, so I've got that. I don't have to cover that base, but people have called me the funniest conservative in America, and I say, funniest conservative on purpose. I'm not by no means the funniest conservative, but at least I intend to be funny.
You know, actually, I'm willing to admit it, but Limbaugh can be very funny. That's part of his appeal,
funny,
isn't it?
Especially earlier in his career, he was particularly good at that. There actually are Bob Dole in Private is extremely funny,
very wry, yeah,
yeah, bitter. they do exist, but it's not something that's usually emphasized.
So you're still calling yourself a conservative, although I was thinking, and in fact, you talk in this book about cleaning out the elephant house, and that suggests maybe the GOP, but you mean politics in general and these pachyderms that fill up an elephant house. Aren't you more a libertarian in some ways?
Well, I am a libertarian. They're not really inconsistent positions. I'm a small c conservative. I generally believe that what we have is plenty bad enough, and that when we change what we have, the change is often for the worse. So I'm always dubious about change. I mean, look, I'm a 63-year-old middle-class guy with three children. You know, change. The whole hope and change thing didn't really do it for me. I had kids late, and my youngest is just six. And at the time of the Obama election, he was just four. And I'm going, we just got our last one out of diapers. Is change a good word? And then I started thinking, is change – how often is change ever a good word? You know, you better change your ways. Spare change, man. Any change in a water mole? You know, you get to a certain age, and it's like – change is like all phone calls after 10 p.m. You know, it's never good news.
Didn't your son, Buster, also play healthcare provider?
I have a joke in there about catching Buster and a little girl from his first grade class playing healthcare provider. They were in lieu
of playing doctor.
Yes. They were filling out forms fully clothed.
Talking again with P.J. O'Rourke, Don't Vote is his title. It just encourages the bastards. You're not really saying to people that they should not exercise their franchise because politicians are so unworthy?
Kind of depends on who's running in their district, doesn't it? I think more ballots ought to have a none-of-the-above option. I have a little bit of a keep in the vote sort of feeling. You know, I've often wanted to do a public service announcement saying, folks, if you don't know the issues, you don't know the candidates, you're not up to speed, you haven't been paying attention, just stay home on election day. You know, we've got all the stupid voters we need. We don't need any more.
Getting back to conservatism for a moment, in your book you talk about the free market as a bathroom scale.
Yeah. I'm trying to get the idea across. I think a lot of misconceptions about capitalism and the free market, I'm all for lecturing people on economics, and it's important to remember that the free market is fundamentally about information. The free market is not a belief system. It's not a creed. It's not something that Ayn Rand acolytes or Tea Partiers or libertarians or conservatives want people to take on faith. Free market is simply a way that we find out a piece of very important information. It's just one piece of information, but it's key, which is how much a given person is willing to pay for a given thing at a given time. That's all the free market does. It tells us that information. But if we lack that information, the results can be disastrous. And the example that I give is the old Soviet bloc. The free market was trying to tell the communists that Bulgarian blue jeans were ugly, and they didn't fit very well, and they were ill-made, and that no one wanted to wear Bulgarian blue jeans. In fact, if you think about it, people behind the Iron Curtain wouldn't wear Bulgarian blue jeans to save their lives.
I'm trying to picture Yeltsin in Bulgarian blue jeans somehow.
Well,
it doesn't
I've
equate.
I've seen a lot of – back in the old days, I saw a lot of people in the Soviet Union in Bulgarian blue jeans, and it wasn't a pretty sight. Anyway, the Kremlin wasn't listening, and the Berlin Wall came down. You know, I mean, it's very important that we know what people are willing to pay for a given thing at a given moment. If we take that information out of the educational system, if we take it out of the healthcare system, if we take it out of any system, dangerous distortions can ensue. I was listening to you last hour, and someone on your, I don't know who it was on your program was saying that $5,000 per year per student is spent on San Francisco public school students?
Yeah, that was a union leader.
That can't be true.
Dennis Kelly.
You know, that simply can't be true. I'll bet you if you look at that, if you factor in capital costs on the building and administration costs, and if you were to take the school system budget and subject it to the kind of spreadsheet analysis that you would a business that you were about to buy, I'll bet you anything that that figure – I don't believe that figure is that low in Mississippi. I seriously suspect – I mean, I know in the District of Columbia it's well over $20,000 per student per year for what is arguably the worst single public school system in the United States.
Although if you heard the last hour, there was talk about changes much for the better in ameliorating some of the problems in D.C., which are featured in this film, by the
way. Yeah, this Waiting for Superman film, which I haven't seen. But it comes from the same people who did An Inconvenient Truth. So
right.
They're not raving right-wingers.
It's interesting what's happened with this. We were talking about – we went to a screening last night because it doesn't open until tomorrow, and I don't want to get off on this. I want to talk about politics with you. Even though you're the heart of an economist, you do have –
That is politics. You know?
Well, you can't separate
politics.
Them.
No, you can't separate them. Public education.
When I'm talking about politics, I'm talking about some of the things that you're griping about, like the politicization of America. But before we do get into that, one of the things that was pointed out was by a number of people was Inconvenient Truth was attacked by the right and by, I suppose, what we call the conservatives, Wall Street Journal, for example. And some of the same people who attacked Inconvenient Truth are loving Waiting for Superman.
Yes.
It's saying – charter schools are great, unions are bad.
Yeah.
I mean, part
yeah.
of it.
Yeah. So I hear, having seen neither movie, I honestly can't say. But I do think the in New York area is there was a Cato Institute paper on this not too long ago on the actual cost of public education, a per student per year expenditure. And it was clear from the, say, 20, so I don't think San Francisco is in the study, but they studied 20 large school district areas. And it was clear that the expenditure and the results don't really seem to have, there's a disconnect there. There are school districts that spend a lot of money and get very good results. There are school districts that spend a lot of money and get terrible results, and vice versa. One thing that it seems to be clear in the argument about American education is it's not – one thing we know for sure is it's not just money.
We're talking to P.J. O'Rourke, his new book, Don't Vote. It just encourages the bastards. Had occasion down in Carmel. You and I were there last year together.
That's right.
This past festival that they put on every year of artists and writers and thinkers.
The Books and Ideas.
Books and Ideas Festival, yeah, brought by the McGillins.
Yeah.
I had occasion to interview Tom Friedman, and we were talking about the Tea Party, and I'm interested in finding out what P.J. O'Rourke thinks about this whole phenomenon. You alluded to it a moment ago, but what Friedman said was, I don't see it as a serious movement. It doesn't seem to have leadership. It's, in fact, he's called it a tea kettle. It's blowing off a lot of steam, and as a populist movement, it's not really going anywhere. It'll have an impact on the election, but not real movement.
I think Tom's all wrong about that. I mean, Tom is... To me, Tom is a more or less endless font of conventional wisdom. You know, whatever it is that most people with nice opinions at the New York Times are thinking, Tom is right there thinking it with them. The world is flat and hot and crowded. Anyway, I actually have spent some time with the Tea Party people, and I'm pretty impressed. I went in a little dubious because I'm not big on populist movements. I think populist movements, the history of populist movements in the United States is rather sketchy. Jacksonian Democrats, I'm no big fan there. The abolitionist movement, while its motives were absolutely wonderful, did they actually bring about the elimination of slavery in the United States any more quickly? If anything, I think they may have hardened it. Worse example would be the agrarian populists, the Free Silver movement in the late 19th century. They were just flakes. You know, I mean, basically wanted to destroy the value of the currency so that they could have lower interest on their farm mortgages. The progressives in the early 20th century, they're the people who led to city planning. From them to Robert Moses is a straight line. So it's just let's take a perfectly good slum, tear it down, and put up an absolutely horrifying project where we do stack-a-prole, where we take poor people and stack them on top of each other in as close a possible proximity.
Although I've just given that nice synopsis of populist movements, I was thinking this is probably more analogous to the 60s and the anti-war movement, and or what was called the movement at any rate, that came from the left.
It is in the sense that it's basically leaderless and that the people who have put themselves at the front of this are a bit embarrassing. Mm-hmm. Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin, just as Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman were a bit embarrassing, the people that have put themselves in front of a popular movement. What I like about the Tea Party is that it has been the tendency for populist movements in the United States to demand greater positive rights from government. You know, positive rights are material rights. Negative rights are your freedom from things, your freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly. These are negative rights. That is to say that my right to religious belief doesn't impinge on your right to religious belief. But my right to housing requires you to give me some material benefit. That's a positive right. Political science, negative, positive, right. Isaiah Berlin came up with the concept some 50 or 60 years ago. And this is a very rare populist movement that isn't demanding increased positive rights. In fact, they are worried about the expansion of positive rights in our political system to the point where it's causing us to run a huge deficit, causing us to experience an expansion of the scope of government into almost every area of life. And are they always the most articulate people? Are they always the most cogent thinkers? No, they're ordinary Americans. They're not used to expressing themselves like this. But are they serious about these things? When I went to meet with various groups of them, I was impressed by the amount of time that they'd spent with things. I mean, they would sit down and give you a little tutorial on the 10th Amendment and enumerated powers. I just like the fact that they are willing to face the problem of expanded positive rights, you know, that they're willing to ask the question, does a system that, say, Western Europe has of enormous social benefits and the costs of those enormous social benefits, difficulty in social mobility, high structural unemployment, low rates of economic growth, is this the kind of thing that suits the character of America?
They're going to hurt the Republican Party, though. There's very little doubt about that. They're going to hurt certain candidacies. Yeah, I think so. Karl Rove thinks so, the architect.
Yeah, maybe. You know, maybe the Republican Party could stand a little hurting. After all, their track records, say from 1994 to the end of the Bush administration, was not exactly stellar. So you're not going to upset me by saying that they'll hurt the Republican Party.
Well, you know, you were talking before about not separating economics and politics. And a quote, this is a quote from P.J. O'Rourke, his recent book, "You can remove morality from politics like you can remove the head from a chicken, and they'll both keep going. Politics much longer than the chicken." You really raise the whole question here. And when we're talking about the Tea Party, it comes to the fore as well about what the role of government ought to be. And some say, well, the role of government primarily ought to be to protect its citizens. But I think you get more into a sense of the importance of government quitting trying to do things and bring about change and maybe just functioning to a much lesser degree than it has functioned traditionally.
I would just say this about government. To some extent, the liberal conservative argument's a quantitative argument about how much government should do. All government is redistributive. Even the most conservative governments do a certain amount of redistribution. Even the most staunch conservative wouldn't argue against all redistribution. We absolutely have to help the helpless. They may not have a right to help, but we have a duty to help them. So, and sometimes duties are a little more important than rights. But there is a question of quantity. And my concern, especially with the federal government, but government with every level, is that over the past 60, 70 years, we have begun to task government, 80 years really, since the beginning of the New Deal, we have begun to task government with more and more of executing our duties. We have been putting a tremendous burden on government. And I don't really think any organization would be able to do all of the things that we ask government to do them well, to do them efficiently, to do them at the minimal possible cost. I don't think that government is particularly inefficient. I think any organization this size would have a pretty considerable inefficiency. Look at GM. There's a reason that they had to go bankrupt. To ask the government not only to guard the coasts and tote the mail, and I'm a little sometimes wonder about toting the mail part, but to also ask it to make everything fair in life for everybody is asking for failure. And even if you're a liberal and you have some very specific things that you want the government to do, say you want the government to women and minorities, you want the government to provide all sorts of opportunities that these people have been historically denied. Okay, I may disagree with you about that, but if that's what you want, you cannot expect the government to be effective at this if you're also asking the government to do 10 billion other things, from making sure the beaches in Panama City, Florida are squeaky clean, to making sure that every stockbroker is honest, forthright in his transactions, to expecting the government to make sure that every woman has daycare, to expect the government to make sure that it goes to Mars. We're simply asking more of the government than any organization could possibly deliver.
Than creating more of a behemoth bureaucracy.
Well, of course. I mean, that's certainly part of it, and creating enormous expense. And I think that we, as Americans, and this is where I give the Tea Party considerable credit, we as Americans have to decide what it is we really want from government, what it is that we really need from government, and require our government representatives to concentrate on those things and just those things, so that the really important stuff is delivered to us. Now, we're going to have to argue about what the really important stuff is. And in this case, maybe even I don't agree with many of the people in the Tea Party, and certainly many of your listeners are not going to agree with people in the Tea Party. But I think the underlying idea that we have to give the government a little bit more focus, that we have to prioritize, decide what is important for government to do, and then get government to concentrate on that, I think that's a good message.
Again, we're talking to P.J. O'Rourke. Speaking about good messages, and you were talking about toting the mail before, we have to be very careful here because of FCC rules, but you use that Trinity game a good deal, kill, marry, or blank. We'll call it blank. It's
hook
the
up.
Hook up. Well, hook up. It's the word that's used for copulation. SWIV is the Middle English word, which is a much better word.
Yes.
It can be used on the air.
Yes.
So you say, for example, the Postal Service, kill the Postal Service, blank Health and Human Services, and marry the Armed Forces.
Well, actually, what I'm talking about is kind of a paradigm of my wife told me about a sort of teenage girls' giggle fest sleepover game that they would play called kill, let's say, kill, cook up with, marry. Where the game is that the girls pick three men, Larry, Moe, and Curly, perhaps, and they have to decide which of these men they're going to have an affair with, which of these men they're going to kill, and which of these men they're actually going to settle down and marry.
It has to be one for each.
Well, it has to be one for each. You have to kill one, you have to have an affair with another, and you have to marry the third. And so she was telling – I mean, this was a conversation that had nothing to do with politics in it.
This is about your daughter, Muffin.
Actually, it wasn't. Muffin's only 12. I don't think Muffin is playing this yet. It's something my mother – my Muffin's mother was recounting from her own youth. And I'm laughing, and I thought, wait a minute, that's politics. That's politics. I said, you know, there are three legs upon which politics rests. Three legs rest. We'll get to verb subject agreement eventually here. In a free society, and it's freedom and power and responsibility. And it's, you know, the kill part is the power part, and the hookup part is the freedom part, and the marriage part is the responsibility. And I said, if you take this girl's sleepover game and you apply this to politics, you actually have a powerful analytical tool. Almost everything that politics does.
You did it with Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, too. But
when we come back, I'll do the 1992 presidential election.
Okay. That's a promise, and that's what we call a tease in radio.
Yes.
Also, you could join us in conversation with P.J. O'Rourke, who has much to say that's serious and much to say that's satirical. Feel free to join the program. Our toll-free number is available to you now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius. It's 866-733-6786. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on the website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. We're spending this hour with P.J. O'Rourke, author of 14 books, including Parliament of Whores and Give War a Chance and Eat the Rich, and His newest book, which is called Don't Vote, It Just Encourages the Bastards. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco this evening, actually this afternoon, 11:15. You can check in. The noon program goes on at noon, and the book signing at 1 o'clock. We've been talking about a lot of serious stuff, like I said to PJ off air, but there's a lot of funny stuff in his new book, as well as a lot of controversial stuff, which you could certainly always expect of him. He says, for example, about climate change, there's not a blank thing you can do about it. There are 1.3 billion people in China, and they all want a Buick. And also tells us that as far as economics are concerned, the best thing that he can say about economics is that he found a, well, you found a $20 bill in your tweed jacket that you didn't know was there.
That's my business. Yes. My the best I've ever done, my best business investment was to find a $20 bill that I left in my tweed jacket in the spring. Just this fall.
A lot of funny stuff, but serious stuff, too. I mean, you talk about politics as original sin and as a lot of committee meetings, and indeed one could think of it in both conjunctions. But you're talking about 1992 before we went to that break.
Yeah. Well, to illustrate this idea of kill...
Hookup.
Kill hookup, Mary. I used the, you know, immediately it occurred to me in 1992 presidential election, obviously you kill Ross Perot, you know, you could hardly avoid hooking up with Bill Clinton. And of course you marry kindly old George H.W. Bush. Now the outcome of the game is not always a foregone conclusion. Witness our surprise elopement with Bill Clinton, as opposed to our walk down the aisle with George Bush. And then you go to the 2000 election. For instance, people of goodwill across America were pretty much evenly divided about whether to go to bed with Al Gore or to marry George W. Bush, though I think we all agreed on killing Ralph Nader by the end of that. And so it goes. But really what it comes back to is this idea of power, freedom, and responsibility, of which the most important is our individual responsibility. We all love our freedom, you know, but we all hate our responsibility.
Have you read Jonathan Franzen's new novel by any chance?
And I'm not gonna.
You're one of the protesters. Backlashed.
No,
because it's about freedom. It is titled Freedom.
It is about freedom. But I read the review in the Atlantic, and I got to say, this sounded like a book that you couldn't get me to read at gunpoint.
I liked it. I thought it was good, strong narrative. I read the Atlantic piece. I thought the author of the Atlantic made some points. It was kind of a backlash piece in many respects because the book has been lauded and given so much praise. In fact, there are a lot of people angry that Franzen made the cover of Time, first American novelist since Updike, and a lot of women writers who caused a whole what we talked about with Franzen as kerfluffle over that. But I wouldn't necessarily go on that Atlantic review.
It just sounded like people I didn't care about doing things that I don't care whether they do.
What can I say? We'll go to our callers and we'll take our first call from Santa Rosa. Damien, good morning.
Hey, good morning, and always good to hear P.J. O'Rourke. Thank you for letting me on the show. I agree with Al Franzen, and I read the review, too, and I couldn't read his book. But the reason I'm calling...
Wait, did you say Al Franzen? I think we're conflating Al Franken and Jonathan Franzen, maybe.
No, I think
I'm
just
Jonathan
about Franzen.
Jonathan Franzen, yeah. I read the review, too, because I heard all about it, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to take a look at the book, and I read the review, and I said, I'm not reading this book. But the reason I was calling was because about the Tea Party. You know, I can appreciate the Tea Party being angry, and I'm kind of angry myself, or frustrated. We're not really angry, frustrated. But they seem to be angry at the wrong things. I mean, they're angry at Obamacare, which is about helping people have insurance for the rest of their life and not be subjected to insurance companies, and not angry about warrantless wiretapping or eavesdropping or the erosion of our civil liberties and things like that. So it just seems sort of weird that they get angry about good things and not angry about the other things.
Well, you know, you're talking about a very amorphous group of people, very spread out, and a number of them I talked to had very serious concerns about one of the points of departure with their anger. Although I must say, none of the people I talked to did I find personally angry. I mean, and screaming and
yelling.
And
you didn't find the racism that has been charged against the Tea Party?
Certainly not. Now, I'm talking about New Hampshire here, and I certainly did not encounter that. I did encounter pretty strong opposition to illegal immigration, but that's hardly limited to the Tea Party. It's not something I happen to particularly disagree. I don't particularly back them on that. But no, I did. A lot of them talked a lot about that, and it hasn't gotten much press attention. That is a serious source of Tea Party anger, is intrusion into personal rights by the government. I found their dislike of the healthcare reform package to be an educated dislike. I found that by and large they were concerned that this reform package had been framed in terms of insurance. And asking such questions as, well, when your house is on fire, do you call Allstate or do you call the fire department? You know, it's treatment is what we're really most concerned about. And I do think there was a certain cynicism in the Obama administration in targeting insurance companies, because nobody likes their health insurance company. So they make a very convenient enemy. But it doesn't really answer the question of, if we're going to provide more health care, better health care to a larger number of people, how is this somehow going to cost less, even if we take away the profits of the health care insurance companies?
Let me thank the caller. Well, one of the big mistakes about health care that both the right and the left have commented on as far as the Obama administration was that there was so much emphasis put on it and so much of an attempt to get it through at a time when the country was looking for better jobs, more jobs, looking for economic improvement. In other words, it almost seemed to be lasered on health care. And a lot of people are still asking from both sides of the political spectrum, why then at that time to the disproportionate and loss perhaps issues?
I think that's a very valid question. I think that you get a certain sort of political stubbornness from this administration. They get an idea in their head and they just can't get rid of it. Let's say for the sake of argument that the ultimate goals of health care reform are something that we all agree upon. I don't think that's quite true, but let's just say that it is true. I mean, we don't want people beggared by the cost of health care. We do want to make sure that people have health care. And we do want to make sure that that health care is affordable in one way, however it is that we end up paying it. Was this the moment to wade into one of the few industries in America that was actually growing and that was actually prospering due to the aging of my generation? It just seemed like a strange moment to be concentrating on a trillion-dollar program at a moment when we were running out of money for everything else. I would have thought a more sensible administration would have said, "And you know, one of our goals, we're going to have to wait till we get through this financial crisis and we get through this, till we get back to a point where our unemployment is down and our economy is growing again. But one of our goals here is, you know, to make sure that all Americans have health care and that all Americans are able to afford the health care that they get." A big project. And sometimes, you know, you can't do every big project. It comes back to that thing. I say you can't have the federal government do everything, and you can't have it do everything at once.
We go to Menlo Park. Todd, you're on. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks, Michael.
Hey Todd.
I haven't talked to you or seen you since, too long ago. We have one thing in common, and that's our alma mater and a creative writing workshop with Professor White.
Oh, my gosh. Miami of Ohio. Miami, the one not on water skis.
One in Oxford.
The one in Oxford, Ohio.
Very good. Way back then, I must say, I felt like you were coming from a different place in the political spectrum, and I wonder if you're a little bit of the embodiment of Winston Churchill's famous quote that if you're not a liberal when you're young, you have no heart, and if you're not a conservative when you're older, you have no brains.
Well, I've always thought there was something to that, but that presumes that my leftist outlook in the 1960s was anything other than a fashion statement and B, a piece of extreme self-interested behavior.
You were part of Rolling Stone. You were in that world.
Well, I did work for Rolling Stone, but I was a Republican by the time I went to work for Rolling Stone. I was their token conservative at that kind of silly publication. Back in the 1960s, I grew my hair long, smoked dope, and protested against the fascist pigs, and because it was a way to get girls. B, I didn't want to be drafted to go. You know, I was perfectly willing to shoot people, but I didn't know these people over in Vietnam. And not only that, they were going to shoot back. You know, if the government had a program for me to shoot my stepfather, I would have been all over it. You know, although I would have wanted to sneak up on him while he was snoring drunk on the couch.
You ever going to write about this?
No.
Stepfather? No.
No, thanks.
I just had to ask.
No, thanks. So, I don't think I ever gave a darn thought to my leftist politics. It was just, it was in the wind. It was like the stupid pants we wore. And once
they weren't Bulgarian.
They weren't Bulgarian blue jeans, but they were equally ugly. And once I did start to think about this stuff, I started to think twice.
Here's a listener. It says, how does PJ feel about the way conservatives turned a blind eye when the government redistributes my wealth to Raytheon, Blackwater, and other components of the war machine?
Well, I can leave out the components of the war machine. You know, that depends on which war and who we're fighting. There are a lot of bad people out there. And I'm all for fighting some of them, Somali pirates, for instance. But I hate corporate welfare. I've got to say it is. If you're looking for something to shame the 1994 Republican takeover of Congress with, the degree of corporate welfare. And then the Republicans have just totally prostituted themselves about things like farm subsidies, and I can say why in two words: Iowa caucuses. That they are willing to give out this $385 billion five-year omnibus bill, agricultural subsidy bill, not a cent of which is necessary. So it's an absolutely valid point. And again, I come back to this infinite expansion of government. You expand government welfare programs, and the next thing you know, instead of the welfare going to the poor people down the block, the welfare is going to Raytheon.
Well, here you've got some opposition, as you might expect. A San Francisco listener writes, when Mr. O'Rourke says the government simply can't do billions of things, he's using very black and white terms. The government that most affects my daily life is the county, which I know very little. School districts are a form of government. UCSF, that is University of California, San Francisco, is a form of government. City councils, even nonprofit management, are all excellent examples of participatory democracy. I think the problem lies in the democracy light version we practice in America. What happened to the power of rotating leadership and not family lines, access to office by debate and not TV blurbs, credible obstacles to corporate union influence? And then another listener, Jerry, says, if not government doing things, then who? Corporations? Where's the trust in this equation?
Well, these are valid enough points. There's no doubt about it. Decentralization of government, I think, is a good thing, although it is messy because it's hard to pay attention to your, especially in these days of declining local newspapers and declining local news. It's hard to pay attention to your county and your city governments. Nonetheless, the smaller government units have something that Governor John Sununu, the former chief of staff to President George H.W. Bush, who is a mechanical engineer, explained to me, and I talk about it in the book. It's a short control loop. He said a short control loop is your hot water faucet in your shower. He said, now short control loop, it doesn't always work. You may be out of hot water. But if you had that shower faucet, if that knob was in the basement of your house, that would be a long control loop. And if you weren't getting enough hot water, you wanted to change the temperature of the water, you had to walk naked and dripping through the house, amazing the children and shocking the cleaning lady all the way down to the grungy basement and fiddle with the faucet down there. That would be a long control loop. And he said federal government is by its nature a long control loop. When your local sewer commissioner ups the sewer rates, votes to up the sewer rates, you can go next door and you can yell at him. You can stuff a potato up the tailpipe of his car. We don't like to do that. We prefer to go to Washington with every one of our problems, straight to the president, bypassing even the House and Congress, and complain to him about the problem, even if the problem happens to be backed up sewage. And the satisfaction we get is not very great. If not government, who? Well, that, of course, is a valid question also. The answer, of course, is us privately. I mean, it's not a matter of turning the prisons over to corporations. I'm not that kind of libertarian. But there are some things that we really should be taking more responsibility for ourselves, notably charity, definitely education. I mean, there is no place on earth for something like No Child Left Behind. The federal government simply has no place instituting something like No Child Left Behind. What if they deserve to be left behind? What if they deserve a smack on the behind, you know?
We're back to schools again, and here's a listener, Dave, who says, I love O'Rourke, but he needs to check his facts. Schools in most California districts fund at less than $6,000 per student, a number comparable with Mississippi, considering the higher cost of operation in California versus Mississippi. It's quite a bit lower in real terms.
I'll accept your information there, and that is criminal. That is criminal. I mean, here you have a big, rich state, and in terrible financial, in terrible state government deficit situation. What the heck are you people spending your money on? Can't you stop with the stupid freeway construction? Can't you stop with some of the junk that you do here and spend a little bit more on the schools? And incidentally, when you do spend on the schools, why don't you pay the teachers and fire the administrators?
We'll go next to Oakland. You're on the air with us. Good morning.
Well, hi, good morning. I agree with a lot of what P.J. O'Rourke says and disagree with a lot of what he says. Similarly, I agree with some of the stuff from the Tea Party and vehemently disagree with some of the stuff coming from them. And I consider myself a socialist or a Marxist or whatever. I think there is a lot of duplicity involved in the current wringing of hands over the federal deficit. Mr. Thomas Friedman's point in his column about the Tea Kettle Party is precisely that. Where were they during the unfettered federal expansion of the military budget since the Reagan, Bush, and Clinton years? Why are they picking on health care at the moment when the other point made by Paul Krugman is the only reason why we got out of the depression is this: when the private sector has the irresponsibility to neglect the country by not spending, it is the place, one of the functions of the government is to print money and spend it liberally so that you get the national economy out of the hole. That's what got us out of the Great Depression.
All right. P.J. O'Rourke.
Well, I think that that listener and I have two such radically different views of economics.
Never the twain shall meet.
Never the twain shall meet. He's, I think, a Keynesian, and I am a monetarist, and I just don't think we're going to have to just agree to disagree.
Well, here's a listener who says, I have a question for P.J. This is up your alley with economics. One concept that seems to be ignored in conservative free market circles is that of the economic externality. That is, the unintended consequence of some economic activity that is not accounted for in the price of the goods. Some of the classic examples are environmental, such as air and water pollution, whereby a private entity is spoiling a public good and not paying the price. Global climate change is, of course, a current example as well. It seems to me that government is the only force available that is capable of addressing serious economic externalities. I concede that they frequently do not do it very well, but would you concede that it is a vital role of government?
Actually, I would concede that it's a vital role of government. There are, I think, ways to focus this vital role of government and to narrow this vital role of government so that the government is more effective at dealing with externalities. This problem is known classically as the tragedy of the commons. While many conservatives can, I think, validly be accused of ignoring this problem, libertarians cannot. Libertarians have spent a lot of thought, a lot of effort, and indeed a lot of study on trying to cope with the tragedy of the commons, trying to cope with externalities. They have some very interesting free market solutions to this. It's not that they think that the free market can do all of it necessarily. It is important to distinguish between libertarians and anarchists. Libertarians don't believe that there should be no government, but that they do believe in the primacy of the individual and the responsibility of the individual.
We had a libertarian candidate on yesterday running. We had the third party Party candidates for governors.
Yes.
He was saying that Jerry Brown and Gray Davis, former governors of California, should be prosecuted for collusion with respect to taking the taxpayers' money. And this is pretty much his position.
Sounds a little extreme. You know, I had a couple of long talks with Jerry Brown over the years, and Jerry Brown has his oddly enough, has his libertarian sides.
He's got a little of everything.
Got a little bit of everything. He is truly a curry mix of political spices.
Well, I've got a listener here who says...
One little thing was that, you know, one of the things that libertarians will point out is that when people have property rights in something like, we talk about overfishing, when people actually have property rights in sections of the ocean, those sections of the ocean get treated a lot better than if those sections of the ocean just belong to everybody, and maybe there's some vague international treaty out there that, you know, that the Russians violate with impunity. So, you know, it's worth taking a look, at least, if you're concerned about the tragedy of the commons and externalities, it's worth taking a look at some of the stuff from the Cato Institute and PERC is another organization, sort of as a free market environmentalist organization, and they have some free market ideas. I can't sit here and say that they'd work for sure, you know, but it's, you know, it's worth exploring.
Well, so is Franzen's novel.
I'm going to have to take your word on that.
Here's John from Livermore. He says, how can you be a libertarian on domestic affairs but a neocon, i.e. in favor of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and foreign affairs? Is that a correct labeling of you?
Well, I don't think I'm a neocon particularly, except that, you know, I became conservative from being part of the New Left. But like I said, I was a very lightweight part of the New Left, you know, and I'm not a very heavyweight neocon. The wars are tough. You know, I spent 20 years as a war correspondent. I'm no fan of war. It is very ugly stuff. I was in favor of the Iraq war because I had been in Kuwait. I had covered the Gulf War. I had seen what the Iraqis had done to Kuwait and to the Kuwaitis. And I was also around, you know, to have a look at what they did to the Shiites in the Basra area of southern Iraq. And I just thought that Saddam Hussein, the Ba'ath Party, the whole organization, they were evil. They were absolutely evil, and I wanted them destroyed. I was in Baghdad while the war was going on. I was in Baghdad a few days after the shock and awe and where we took over the city. Our initial reception in Baghdad was neutral to mildly friendly. The tragedy in that war to me was that we left millions of people without water, without food, without medical attention. We in the words of Colin Powell, we broke it, but we didn't buy it. We had a very successful military invasion, but we made no provision for the civilian population of Iraq after that invasion. And they were in no position to help themselves. It certainly wasn't their fault. So that was wrong. It was bad. I've been to Afghanistan. I've been up on the Pakistan in the tribal areas. The Taliban are bad people. I wish I knew some better thing to do with them than shoot them. I'd like to, you know, have a long talk with them and kind of talk them out of their position. But that
you think you have the metal to do that?
No, I don't, and nor do I think it would work. Sometimes when you're dealing with really bad people, there isn't much you can do except deal with them in the traditional bad people method of dealing with bad people.
We'll go to another caller. Kay, hi. Join us on the air.
Oh, hi. For a really terrific... I'm going to say really quickly, as a former...
You're breaking up badly.
Yeah, we're
there.
Not getting much in the way of a good call there, I'm sorry to say. Panama City, Florida caller. Paul, hi. You're on the air.
Panama City, Florida. I was just down there.
Yes, sir. It's a beautiful place.
Thank it is.
Thank you for my call today. Mr. O'Rourke, I just wanted to ask real quick what you know about and what you think of the fare tax, House Resolution 25. Thanks a lot. Y'all have a good one.
Well, he's got me there. You know?
We could do a whole hour on the fare tax.
Any idea, Michael?
Actually, why don't we just go to another caller? I don't want to get off on the fare tax. He wanted your opinion anyway. Thomas, go ahead.
They're not going to tax state fares, are they? That would be bad.
Well, I kind of wanted to bring it back to the state. I have some experience in education, teaching, and I also volunteer at an after-school program. And I noticed that you can throw as much money at education as you want, but really, it's one of the most poorly run systems in the U.S. Education system, of course, is no surprise. But my question is, like, instead of putting money into schools to pay for computers that end up getting locked up and for refurbishing bathrooms that go under lockdown that no one can use, why don't we start providing incentive for grades? So if kids want to get, $25, they can get it if they earn an A. You know, they can get $15 if they earn a B.
Yeah, you got a lot of parents who talk about the failure of that system within the economics of their own family. PJ?
It couldn't hurt. I mean, incentives are good. We know that people work for incentives, which brings my main thrust of educational reform. If I want to increase the pay of teachers and at the expense of facilities and administrators, because for many years when I was a kid, for instance, a school teacher was a low-paid job. It was a high-status job. It was this high-status job within the community. And I think it's lost some of that. And I'm sorry, we live in a more crass world maybe than we did 50 years ago. But one way to bring back the status of teachers is to pay them more. And certainly it would attract better people. It would keep better people. There's no doubt about that. But it would also increase their status within the community, and indeed probably their status with the kids. A little more discipline probably wouldn't hurt either. Back in when I went to school, I didn't go to a great school. And the neighborhood was, part of the neighborhood was pretty rough. We had some tough kids in the school, but you didn't step out of line, and I'm not even sure why you didn't step out of line. We didn't get hit that often. It did happen occasionally, but it was basically because if you got in trouble with your teacher before you even got home, your mom knew that you had been in trouble with a teacher, and then you got in really bad trouble at home.
Sure. And that was to be avoided at all costs.
Ooh, yeah.
On that note of trouble at home in the grade schools that we went to in Ohio, we've come to the end of the hour. Always good to have you here.
Michael.
Thank you so much.
Michael, thank you very much.
And you can meet PJ O'Rourke. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club this afternoon, a noon program. Just an hour. Meantime, we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening, and want to extend thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and our interns, Nadia Reed, Elena Caravani, and Aiden Stone. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.